Three, two, one.
The homicide detective went down to the basement level of Hamilton General Hospital. He entered the forensic pathology department, where he was handed a styrofoam box. He carried it out of the hospital to his unmarked car, placed it on the passenger seat beside him, and was soon driving on the highway, his hand supporting the box in case he had to brake quickly. The box contained a skull.
This is The Message. I'm John Wells with producer Aisha Nasser. This episode of our podcast is titled True Detective. The Hamilton police officer in that story I read from was Dave Place, and the murder he was investigating was featured in a series I wrote in the Spec years ago called Postmortem, that was later published as a book by the same title. That true-to-life CSI-style homicide case was just one of many Dave Place worked over the years. He retired just before Christmas from Hamilton Police Service following a career that included working in the Major Crimes Unit, where he reported to Hamilton homicide scenes, interrogated suspects, witnessed autopsies, and unimaginably had to knock on doors and tell the loved ones of victims the worst news of their lives. When I first met Dave years ago for an interview, I was struck by his physical presence. I'm 6'2", but he towered over me at 6'5" and 220 pounds, and I thought how intimidating he would be to a murder suspect facing him during an interrogation. Except for the paradox that Dave Place also has a soft-spoken, professorial manner to him. On second thought, maybe that combination would have shaken up suspects even more. But I suspect Dave would say, if asked, and I will ask him, that intimidation was not his MO, unlike homicide cops you see on TV shows. He was after the truth, and during his years on the police service, he was, a senior officer once told me, among the best at finding it. And here is Dave Place, off the beat, newly retired, and in the studio on The Message. Dave, thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You know, in hindsight, it might seem that policing was always going to be your career. You had how many years with the service, first of all?
33 and a half years.
But you got your start in a roundabout way in terms of your first career track. You were in retail, were you?
I did. Actually, I finished high school. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew I had to go to work. I started working in a warehouse. And I moved on. It was Sears Warehouse at the time.
Sears, yeah.
And I moved throughout the warehouse, different areas there. I got into the store as an assistant manager of sporting goods. That was my big break. And next thing you know, 11 years had passed. And a friend that I'd started in the warehouse with said, "What are you doing here? You're not going to go anywhere." He'd left a long time before. Mm-hmm. And he gave me an application for the OPP. Mm. And the first thing they ask is, "Are you willing to relocate anywhere in Ontario?" Which I wasn't. But I went and got an application for Hamilton. That was in early 1985, and within a few months, I was hired as a recruit.
Right. And so, and since then, you've worked in a homicide branch, major crimes, and in the fraud branch, and in uniform as well.
Yeah, generally, the first 10 years you can count on being in uniform.
Right.
There's different opportunities, you know, training officer, scenes of crime officer, things like that. But generally, 10 years in uniform. And depending how well you're doing, I guess, you might have the opportunity to move on. And that's exactly what happened to me.
Right. Now, when I met you several years ago now, it was with respect to your role in major crimes and investigating homicide.
Right.
And it's an area that people are fascinated with. It's no secret that it's a huge topic for Hollywood and TV shows and movies, that sort of thing. My understanding from dealing with you and others over the years is that, you know, work in homicide is characterized by bursts of intense work. You get the late night phone call from the office that there's been a sudden death, perhaps a very violent death. You end up going hard into the early hours and days of a murder investigation, kind of thing. How did you feel about that pace of the work and getting those calls and that intensity?
Well, that was 1999 when I started in major crime, mm-hmm. And at that time everybody was carrying pagers.
Mm,
so
right.
I remember I had my pager like everybody else, and it would sit on my dresser at night, and frequently, you'd hear that buzz and knew that it was time to jump into action. And away you went, typically a phone call to the inspector to find out what the general premise was, and then head down to major crime and away you go.
Did you have a family, have a couple of kids?
Yes, I have four kids, actually.
Four. Okay. Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, back then, you know, in 99, say, did you dread getting that pager, or did you relish it, or something in between?
Well, it was, it's not something I looked forward to getting, but I knew it came with the territory, and it was time to get to work. Yeah, you didn't know how long you were going to be, what you were going to encounter. You know, you might be gone. I think the longest I was away was 36 hours at a stretch, but yeah. Sometimes, typically these happened at night when you would get the call, and you'd go in and do your initial assessment. They typically called in as many major crime officers as were available, and you'd go in and assess the situation, look after anything that needed to be done immediately as far as securing the scene, notification of family, if that was appropriate at that time, you know, potentially get the pathologist involved, maybe have them come to the scene. Mm-hmm. So it was more preliminary things to tidy things up and secure things and get them tied down before the real investigation, I guess, started.
And I was struck researching some of these stories about how, you know, the major crime detectives will always be wearing suits. Was that part? That was basically the uniform. You know, you get the call and you're having to go into what could be a nasty crime scene, but you put the suit on.
Yeah, that's true. You jump into your suit and head down and meet the other officers that had been called in or had responded. I generally have a briefing, usually with the officers first on scene, and anybody with a significant piece of information would be involved in this briefing. And then you would go from there.
Right. You mentioned one of the tasks could be notification. That is going to the family of a victim.
Right.
And informing them. What I said in my intro was, you know, basically giving them the worst news they'll ever receive in their life. What was that like? How'd you approach that? It's something I think most people would find unimaginable in terms of having to do that.
It's a horrible thing to do, but it has to be done. Mm-hmm. Working in our criminal investigation branch, we were required to do that in relation to motor vehicle accidents, things like that, that may have happened in Hamilton or elsewhere, and we would get the request to go do the notification. Mm-hmm. And we're fortunate in Hamilton to have had the victim services branch. So they would deal with the kind of the emotional follow-up to it. So yes, we were lucky there. But all you could really do was be armed with as much information as possible, which in some cases was minimal, and even less information that you were able to provide to them, even if you had information for an active case. We didn't really have a lot of information that we could share with the family, but right, you know, to do it in a professional way and be as empathetic as possible, it was very hard.
Yeah. Right?
But and devastating news, like you said, for these families who never had any idea. You know, it's a knock on the door, usually late at night, which I imagine would invoke some strong emotions if it happened at my house.
Yes.
And you're delivering, like you say, horrible news that's going to affect them for the rest of their life. So just to do it professionally and in a caring way and have some follow-up, you know, with the victim services people was very helpful.
Is there a crime scene that you were called to that sticks out in your mind as one, you know, in terms of the atmosphere, how violent or unusual it was during your days on major crime?
So there's so many, not just in major crime, but in uniform, you know, being out on the road, you're dealing with victims of collisions and pedestrians getting hit, and so many scenes that are awful.
Yes.
Probably the first one that I can recall that left an impact was, I hadn't been on very long, it was down on Kinraid. I believe it was 56 Kinraid. There was a double homicide there. Mm-hmm. So back in those days, they would lock down the scene and it would be secured overnight. Now you'd have a car parked outside, but at that time we would actually sit inside the scene, guarding it overnight until the forensic guys could get in there with their video and fingerprints, right, and doing whatever they're doing. So I was assigned to sit in the house at 56 Kinraid overnight, and it was a bit surreal. And then the day after, when the forensic guys, I think it was just one guy at the time, came in, it was very interesting because he was able to kind of point out what had happened, you know, the order that things had happened based on his evaluation of the evidence and any information he had. So
right,
for me, that was really interesting. Like it was a horrible scene, and it was
blood and the whole thing.
Yeah, terribly tragic circumstances, but to look at the science behind it and to see how the forensics guy, you know, somebody with some specific training, was able to piece it together to get the flow of what had happened. There were two dead women in there, so
mm-hmm.
so to be able to piece it together was crucial, and I found it very interesting.
Along those lines, attending post-mortem examinations, autopsies. You know, years ago, for one of my stories, I watched a video of an autopsy just so I could get a sense of what it's like. And to the uninitiated, it's disturbing to see it. But of course, for certainly homicide detectives, it's a regular part of the job attending these postmortems. So what was that like for you?
Well, we get typically had exposure to a postmortem early. They say let's take the recruits down to an autopsy, you know, to introduce them to how it all works. And
right,
I don't remember the first one I was at, but occasionally we had to do them when I was working in CID. And then once you get to major crime, then they have to have somebody there for continuity purposes, keeping an eye on what's happening. So I found them interesting, disturbing for sure, to see what goes on.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at it scientifically, most of the pathologists were very good. They would kind of walk you through. If you showed some interest, they would say, "Well, this is what I'm doing, and this is what this is, and this is the significance of that." So it was all. I found them pretty fascinating and not overly disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I did have to do one for a baby, and that was completely disturbing.
That's a whole different
for a long time.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
It's interesting. I remember interviewing Sheetra Rao, forensic pathologist, and she actually told me that she declined to do infant autopsies. That it was something she, you know, there was someone who did hundreds of them, but that's anyway, for you, that stuck with you, having to witness that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was, and now if I hear of an infant death, my heart goes out to the people that have to take part in that.
Right.
I guess some people are more well equipped to deal with that emotionally, but
mm-hmm.
I can't imagine it not having an impact.
Right. You know, one of your specialties as a police officer, I think it's fair to say, or I'll say it, was interviewing suspects, interviewing the interview process, certainly with respect to homicides and so on. And you know, again, on TV, you see police officers, you know, it's Hollywood, but you know, they're intimidating suspects, they're yelling in their faces and trying to get answers that way. You, as I've written about, you know, you're a big guy, but you're mild mannered, soft spoken. What was your approach to trying to get information from people who might not want to give you information?
Well, if I can, I remember how this all began. I was interviewing a girl who was the suspect for an employee theft.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asking her questions, and every question I asked her just kind of reinforced in my mind, oh yeah, this girl's responsible for this theft. But I didn't know how to take it from that to have evidence that I could use to charge her with. So I went in search of some answers, and I talked to several of the guys, the crusty old CID guys at the time, and anybody who I thought may have some answer to this, and I couldn't find anybody that really had an approach to it, right? I'm sure they were all very effective in
a systemic sort of approach.
Right.
Yeah.
But I couldn't find anything. And so I started to look, and eventually was able to put together a formula, basically, for
right.
here's not just textbook, but from different sources, here's what you want to accomplish. I was showing you earlier this mm-hmm. quote from Freud. He says, "Self-betrayal oozes through our pores because we mortals cannot keep secrets." And when you think about that, and the fact that it's not just the written word that we're getting information from, you know, it's only 7% of the information that people are conveying in an interview is verbal, right? So
right.
you've got paralanguage, and you've got kinesics, I think is the word, and that other 93% is all coming from there. So you need to pay attention to, you know, not just what they're saying, but how they're saying it.
Right.
I had the benefit of going on a number of training courses,
right.
and so it all helped me in my own little way to come up with this recipe, I guess, for interviewing people. And it
right.
didn't matter if it was witnesses or suspects. Basically, the goal was to elicit information from people, but not contaminated by me. So uninfluenced completely by me as much as possible when I'm getting this information. So that was my main goal. And with some of the courses that I had in, I don't know, statement analysis and just interviewing in general, and then some exposure that I had to different things like body language,
mm-hmm.
physiognomy,
wow.
Which is
yeah.
the it's an ancient, I don't know if it's a study, but it's based on the shape of the physical characteristics of someone's face. You know, this
and how it changes as they're speaking or something?
No. So this was a study by Aristotle. Like, that's the generation
yeah.
we're looking at. So if somebody's got a thin upper lip, it means this. If they've got they've got big ears, it means they're a good listener. I remember that one because I have big ears. Right? So those kind of things. And I kept an open mind about all these things. Neurolinguistic eye movement.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't studying all these things acutely as the interview went on, but I kept an open mind, and all those things were available as tools to use during this interview. So once you've got your information as much as possible, and then you're assessing the information, am I dealing with truthful information
mm-hmm.
or is it deceptive? And then you can go from there.
That's a long way from slapping someone in the face and
you see the films and you hear the old stories, right, about the
There was some of that in the old days.
People dressing up in bunny suits and people getting whacked with phone books and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, how much of that actually happened, I don't know. But you have to keep in mind, presumably you want your interview, the evidence that you get from your interview, to be admissible in court.
Right.
So you need to make sure that charter issues are in place,
right,
so it's not
going to
get tossed. By the time you get into court, everything is arguable. I remember I got grilled for an hour or so. My choice of the word, this is your opportunity to make a statement.
That's what you said to a suspect, this is your opportunity, and you got grilled on saying that.
It was opportunity or chance. What's the
yeah.
difference? You know, the defense was implying that by whatever word I'd used,
yes.
there was an advantage to it. And,
right.
and I said, no, in my mind, they're synonymous, right? And that's how I saw it,
yeah.
but of course they made a deal about it. I don't remember what the outcome was,
yeah.
but I remember one time we were bringing a suspect back from another service, and he wanted a coffee. And the issue was, so is that an inducement? He says, I've got my money. I got my own money. I'll buy my coffee. So we kind of joked, the other officer and I. So is this considered an inducement if we let the guy buy his own coffee? And it's a bit ridiculous, but something like that could become an issue in court.
Yeah.
Or giving a guy a cigarette or something like that.
It's a fine line you have to walk.
Yeah.
Interviewing a suspect, let's say, you know, for a homicide, for example, what were the sort of words or phrases or expressions that you would look for that could be telltale signs about whether they're telling the truth or not when you're asking them whether or not they've done something that they weren't supposed to do?
Well, through this statement analysis training that I had, and I guess it's not an exact science, but for people to show commitment to what they're saying, you want first person singular past tense, right? So I did this, I did that, and that way they're showing commitment to
right. I didn't do it is showing commitment.
Right. So in that format, you're getting some commitment. If they say, we did this, and you know there's only one person there, then that's a problem, right? Or if they change tenses, right? So from past tense to present tense, right? So I did this, I did that, we do this type of thing. It stands out. It's funny because I'm reading a book right now by an FBI profiler. And in this book, he builds himself up quite significantly. But so he's telling these stories, you know, first person singular past tense. And then when he's given examples that are a little bit incredulous, the nature of the story, but he changes to present tense. And to me, it really stood out. And I'm thinking, well, wait a second. Everything else is first person past tense. So why would he put this little story in present tense? And it threw me off. And then you'd go back to past tense. And another one, well, here's another story. And it's present tense. But as the book goes on, not all the time. Right? So he's able to tell other stories. So it just makes me wonder, why would that happen, right? The change is significant for some reason, but so I can't say that he's lying, but there's a change. So something has changed in the way he's telling the story, and it makes me wonder why. Right? So if you're interviewing somebody and they're telling the past first person singular past tense, and then they change, that's significant.
Right. There's such a science to it, you know. It's amazing.
And so it doesn't mean that they're guilty, but something has changed. Maybe there's something else that they're trying to hide. They don't want that part exposed to their family or something like that. Mm-hmm. But the fact that there's a change is significant. So those are the kind of things that you look for.
I read off the top of the podcast just a brief quote from the postmortem story about the Yvette Budrum case. A fascinating sort of a true CSI story is how it was billed at the time in the paper and so on. And I was reading from a part where I wrote how you took the skull of the victim in a box with you to get a composite sketch done of the victim. And also in that same story, people were fascinated by the bug lady, the forensic entomologist Dale Morris, who you worked with on the case. What was it like working with her? She was trying to determine the time of death of the victim who had been found in a field near African Lion Safari using blowflies and larvae and so on, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So that was, I met Dale once before in another case where she did that work. And she's extremely committed to her work and her flies and larvae and whatnot, but it was an interesting process. That was one of the things working in major crime there. You're exposed to so many specialists in their fields.
Right.
But so for Dale, it was important to have all the larvae, pupae and the maggots themselves collected, and she needed the environmental information to go along with that. So we hung up I think it was called a data logger, you know, hung it up in the tree, and we're comparing information with the Hamilton Airport for humidity and temperature and sunset and all that. And then based on all that, and I guess the emergence of particular species of flies, whatever they were, allowed her to work backwards to the time of death, like very, very closely. I guess the flies start to infiltrate the body almost at the time of death. So right. It was very interesting, but talking about contamination, it was important that she not be given information ahead of time,
right,
that the defense could arguably say, well, of course you come up with the same date because that's what the police
told
you. That's
right.
What they thought it was.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I remember you telling me that you ended up going to Reardon's to buy some raw liver,
yes,
for her to conduct her experiments and so on, which all part of the job, right?
Well, but that was my every time I saw Reardon's, that's the first thing I thought of, because she needed she needed a piece of liver to keep these maggots alive.
Yeah.
And so I went to Reardon's and bought a 25-cent piece of liver, and they charged me for it. I thought that was kind of funny.
Well, all in the line of duty.
Dave,
you know, it's I wish we had more time. We should have you on for part two of the show. So you retired last month. What's next for you? What do you have on the go from here?
No, I've got I've been advised to take 6 months off, you know, without making any commitments. With my fraud background, there's some opportunities with
private investigations, that kind of thing.
Yeah, or? Private investigations, banks, insurance companies, things like that. There's some opportunities, but I'm going to take my time, and I've got some renovations to do around the house that I can pick away at them for a while, and do some travel with my my wife and maybe the kids if they behave, and see where things go. I'm not one for sitting around, but so far I've only been gone for about 3 weeks, so it hasn't been an issue so far, but it's nice.
Right. Well, you know, a fascinating career, and you know, ongoing, to be continued, and congratulations on the retirement, and thanks for coming in today on The Message.
Well, thank you very much, John. I appreciate the chance to tell my story.
I'm John Wells for Aisha Nasser. We'll talk to you later.